Welcome to the Agile Wire, brought to you by Wisconsin Agility. We want you to get agile and stay agile. Now here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Chad Beyer.
And we're recording. All right, kick us off, Jeff.
All right. On the podcast today, we have Ryan Ripley, Todd Miller, Kurt Bittner, and Patricia Kong. We're going to be talking about unlocking business agility with evidence-based management, their new book that all four of them wrote.
I think it'd be interesting from everyone's perspective, go around the room, and I don't know, in one word or two or three words or maybe just one sentence, like, what's a phrase, like, why should someone read this book? Or you could answer it this way, like, what's the outcome impact you want for a reader of this book?
I'll go. I'm going to say goals. Everybody's terrible at goals. ABM is a goal-driven framework. If that's the most you get out of this book is just rethinking your goals, I would be incredibly happy.
Cool.
Yeah, the thing I would add to that, and I can't do it in two words, but I think I would say, assume everything that you think is wrong and work from there.
That's great. Sure.
So test everything, doubt everything, you know, get evidence for everything. Don't believe anybody, regardless of their rank or position in the company, especially maybe because of their rank or position in the company. And just, you know, because, there's a fair amount of data that we talk about in the book that most ideas miss the mark. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but somewhere in there, accidentally, you'll stumble across something that does. But if you're not measuring, you won't know it. And goals.
I like that I had to search the word ego in the text, and it shows up. Check your ego at the door, right? And it's all about being open-minded, being humble, vulnerable. Like, admit that nobody knows where to go next in product development. You've got to iterate your way, experiment your way into the future. So I like that.
So Kurt's word would either be skeptical or paranoid. I'm not sure which.
I like to lean on skeptical, but...
There you go. There you go.
If I'm off my meds, paranoid, yeah.
My word would probably be a curse word, which isn't going to work here. So I'll say something like augment, or even evidence. And so evidence-based management, it comes from Ken Schwaber, right? The origins of it and how he was thinking about it. And I remember a conversation we were having where he talked about how a lot of people were using Scrum, right? So he created Scrum, co-created Scrum, and he's like, but it's not working, it's terrible. And he said, the one thing that I really wish that I added were the concepts around evidence-based management, around evidence. And so this notion for me of augmenting and adding to that mindset that you need to really develop that accountability exists here, and especially with the conversations I think that we're seeing out in the market right now about, oh, we're using 20 different things, a roll your own framework, agile, and scrum masters get fired and blah 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 blah. And it's just like, if people could just think about this way and think about truly what empiricism can do for their work, and add that on to just, oh, we're doing the mechanics of something, that I think we'd be a little bit more happier at work.
Great. Sure.
What do you think, Tom? Todd? Like, what are your...
Thanks for calling me Tom.
Tom, Todd, you know.
Those are three, you know, hard acts to follow. But I think I can summarize it really when it comes to an organization, a product, or whatever you may be working on, is what you're doing actually working, or does it just feel that way? And I think that we can get major tunnel vision based off of our feelings. We can get very subjective. We get stuck on ideas. I mean, there's a lot of stuff around the sunk cost fallacy. There's all these things that we see in office environments that are tied to, well, it feels like employees are happy. It feels like our customers really like what we're doing. But do they actually, right?
I think that's a good answer, Tom.
Tom, you did a great job. Remember, so the sunk cost fallacy, I think there's a, that chapter.
It would have to happen to me, right? It would have to happen to me.
What's so funny is we know you, Todd. It's not like we don't know your name. It's just Jeff said Tom.
This is for just some the reason. Kind of thing that happens to Tom Miller.
You know, I will say about this whole, like the four of us, like, you know, we got this book out. There's a nice little picture of it. We stayed friends throughout, which I think is a major feat too. Just, I mean, we're laughing, we're joking with each other. We're still, Todd and I are still business partners. I mean, it didn't, something like this can really just wreck people. And I think it's really cool that we got to the end of it and no one's looking to like jump off this podcast or off a call quickly, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm putting myself in like a listener's shoes here and I'm thinking, okay, so it's goals. Like, goals. You're going to make me do something. We have no shortage of goals in our organization. Why should I do this EBM thing? Like, how would you answer that question?
Read.
Because you have no clue whether or not. What's that?
I was just going to say, you take it, Trish. I was just going to say, read. Like, just read the book. Like, yeah, there's no shortage of goals. Why did the goals suck? I don't know. Ryan, you go. I'm getting angry.
No. I kind of agree. You know, yeah, definitely read the book. Read the book. But I think it's because the goals suck. You know, there's a story in the book where that's based off of a consulting gig that I did once where I'm at a client site and they've got 9 OKRs. And I asked a very simple question, like, how many of these have you ever accomplished in a year? And they said, well, we usually get 2 or 3 done. So why do you have 9? And why are these so poorly written? And how are you going to measure? And how? And it just, the questions just go on and on and on and on. And I think that's why it's, you know, goals at the beginning, because, you know, look, I just read a book on sprint goals a little bit ago that doesn't tell you how to write a good sprint goal. And I just read, I'm working through these other books like Measure What Matters on OKRs and Evidence Guided and digging through all the literature. And it's just the idea of how do you write a good goal and then directionally stay aligned to it and then actually deliver something of value is just so misunderstood. This filled the gap. You know, some of that new territory I talked about that Todd and Trish and Kurt really plowed really answers a lot of that stuff. So I think that's why goals, that's where we start.
This is a good point for me to do my usual rant about outcomes versus outputs and activities.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we find with a lot of organizations, scrum teams, kind of everybody, is that their goals are stated in terms of either outputs or activities. And what I mean by that is like produce this, you know, produce this PBI, you know, deliver this report, you know, deliver this feature, you know, those are all output examples. Activities are even worse because like do this, you know, run this report, you know, run that, you know, do that, you know, have this meeting. And, you know, you can take those and ask yourself, why are we doing that? Why are we producing that report? Or why are we delivering that feature? And there's always something, you know, if you look at activities and outputs, there's always something else behind it. It's like, well, we want to achieve this thing. Oh, okay. Well, let's talk about that. And ultimately, if you keep asking why, you get to something that's more like a customer outcome. What thing should the customer be able to do that they can't do today? Where are they dissatisfied today that we can make them more satisfied? And so by focusing on outcomes instead of outputs and activities, you get to what the real goal is. And then you can say, well, does it even make sense to do that thing? You know, does that PBI even make sense? Is it going to help us achieve that outcome? If the answer is no, then okay, let's drop that, you know, and let's do something else. And so I think that more interesting conversations happen when you get to outcome-oriented goals. And I mean, goals are just really triggers for conversations. It's almost going back to the original user story definition, which was really good. It's just a placeholder for a conversation. And so I think of goals that way. It's like we get to talk about what are we trying to achieve here? And then we can figure out what we think is the best way to do that and how we measure it and all those things. But Ryan's right. You know, most goals that we've seen are, you know, they're focused on the wrong things. They don't talk about what the real goal is. And then, you know, you get to the end of a sprint and you go, well, did we achieve our sprint goal? And the sprint goal is like to do these five PDIs. It's like, yeah, we did. But did that matter? No. Anyway, so rant off.
Good rant.
Well, I think, you know, there's an additional element to this because the goals conversation is a difficult, slow moving conversation in a lot of instances because it starts at the top. And what I find when you start working with teams and you start talking about EBM, the people get fixated on the measurement side of it. And what is empowering of it, though, when you start to really understand EBM, and one of the hopes of our book is that it enables employees to ask better questions about goals. And so rather than just say, okay, our goal, yeah, let's make lots of money this year. I don't care. I'm leaving at five anyway. While the CEO pulls in the Maserati, it's more like, but why are we doing this? What's the true point behind it? It's empowering. So there is this level of here's your strategic thing that we hope to get for our company in the next 3 years, and it's make tons of money. We know how that makes employees feel. That kind of information has been around for a long time. But really, the way to solve it in a lot of instances for me is to empower people that are actually building, from a developer to a product owner or product manager, to ask better questions, to create organizational alignment, and then hopefully get up to that level where they're saying, okay, you know what? We really need to tell a better story of why, because we keep hearing this. And so we're lucky enough that we're pulled onto consulting engagements. We oftentimes have those kinds of relationships with people, and we can ask that at the C level. But a lot of these times, these people don't. And so we're hoping that level reads this book. We're also hoping that we get a level that reads this book that can come into an environment and ask questions and then show some measurements that are saying we'd have a disconnect. We don't know what to put in current value. We don't know what satisfaction gap we're trying to fill. Why are we doing this, right? But ask it in a way that's not just accusatory. Ask it in a way that's intelligent. So that's what Tom thinks.
Good answer, Tom.
Everybody on this that doesn't know me is going to be like, oh, Tom Miller.
It must be really unfortunate that the book already got printed with Todd on it, though.
Yeah.
Can't really go back now, so.
Jeez, every single time. It could have been worse. Could have been a worse nickname.
You know, I feel like coming from the why question, I mean, it's so common, right? Like, it's really common sense, actually, a lot of the stuff we talk about with organizations, and just asking why like a toddler has quite an impact no matter where you're at in the organization, right? Whether it's refining one single product backlog item or whether you're questioning a really large strategic goal for the org, if you don't have the why articulated, it's probably just noise. And I think you have a chapter or a section about signal the noise ratio. Is that what it was? Separating the signal from the noise.
Chapter five.
Yeah. And thanks for bringing up some trauma from my past in project management days. You have a beautiful screenshot of this, as you guys call it, an incredibly noisy project status report. And I don't know, I think that's kind of what we're saying, right? Like that project status report, I'm not going to describe it in detail. We probably all know what I'm thinking of, but it says a lot without saying anything at all, right? Because it's so focused. Yeah, there you go. Ryan's got the visual. Or maybe we should start calling Ryan Brian from this point forward. Everybody's going to get, Ryan says no. So anyway, I just remember how much waste there is in some of the things that well-intended people have, right? There's a project manager who's just trying to get through their day, as I remember, and lots of stress, lots of tension in the org, and you have to go through the motions of the project status report, but it doesn't give you anything. And I like that the focus here is check your ego at the door. You get into empowerment in the last chapter about the org and in the last section, right? And just have real conversations and use real impactful data if you're going to visualize it.
If we're thinking about, you know, who we used to be and some of the people out there with those busy dashboards, I think that's why the key value areas is something, you know, these four little circles. I don't know, it's not the best graphic, but for some reason it's really compelling and meaningful to people because that why question gets so hard. And so Todd was talking about current value and there's unrealized value, ability to innovate and time to market. And when we just start using those types of areas and thinking about the value and thinking about just what are a couple measures or a few measures that would be in there that would be significant that could help us think about what we're doing and the balance and the lens that we're taking. I think that's helpful for people when they're struggling a little bit to kind of say, here's some information that we have that can help us have a more impactful conversation about goals, because likely they're not great goals, they don't exist or something like that. But sometimes the key value areas is a place where people can start to think about what have we been focusing on? What are we not focusing on? I know there's some clients out there, have the conversation with them about goals, have them think about the key value areas. And at the end, they just sometimes just hone into still time to market and you know, hopefully they can get beyond that.
Well, that noisy project status report, you know, as Trish is pointing out, is just so flawed. You know, and on it, there's the watermelon status, you know, is the project green or red? And by the way, they're always red. There's no green project until the end, right?
No, the other way around. The projects are always green until the end, and then they turn red.
Well, that's the lie we tell, right?
Yeah, okay.
That's the...
Exactly.
You know, of course it's green, and then magically the day before release, it's red, and... You know, it's just a lot of nonsense. It's, you know, it's task driven. It's project management driven. It's things that are easy to measure but are meaningless when trying to make a better decision about direction. And that's what we're really trying to, you know, we don't want it to be a sledgehammer over, you know, the PMO director's head, but we want them to look at this and think, there are other things I could be measuring to look at the health of this effort and to see if we're actually getting, to see if the juice is actually worth the squeeze, right? Are we actually, you know, a lot of this is even around stewardship. Are we actually spending dollars well? Are we getting the value that we expect? And if not, have we made appropriate changes to get there? Mm-hmm. And I think so many of these topics just don't get discussed, right? It's just, hey, we're on time, we're on budget. And scope was met. We won, right? Go buy the cake, throw the party, delete all the files, and make sure we're never audited. That's a typical project. This book pushes for more. We think you can do better.
Well, one thing that I think a lot of, and we talk about this in actually a lot of places in the book, but it's dealing with transparency and dealing with basically, you know, since honest reporting of how things are is really difficult for many organizations because, you know, on that status report, you know, there's this pressure to show everything's great. And I remember sitting in meetings with teams and they had to do a weekly status report and they would argue about, well, you know, it's green, but it's kind of a yellow shade of green. And, or, you know, they get into what I started calling project chromatography. The problem is that in traditional organizations, when you encounter negative news, the first knee-jerk reaction in managers is to essentially, oh my God, you know, and, you know, swarm the project with all sorts of management attention, which usually means, you know, figuring out who's to blame, you know, doing punishment and then, you know, getting on with things. And I had this manager years ago, had a great phrase, and it was the facts are friendly. You know, it's just data. It just tells you where you are. And then you can use that to inspect and adapt, in our terms, to figure out how to do it better. But training a traditional organization to not just sort of hammer the team for what looks to them like negative information, like, well, you know, you didn't hit your sprint goal. Oh, well, that's interesting. You know, so let's understand why that was. Was it a reasonable goal? You know, maybe, you know, did something else come up? Oh yeah. You know, there was the whole building burned down during the week. So, you know, it's just data, and getting people used to that and comfortable with that is essential in order for the team to feel comfortable with transparency. Because if they don't feel comfortable with transparency, they're going to tell you what you want to hear instead of what you need to hear.
Yep.
And that's, I think, to me, that's the hardest thing about a lot of the things that we talk about in EBM, is that getting the organization to be comfortable with just facts are facts. You know, it's not, you know, nobody needs to be punished. I mean, maybe at some point, but, you know, I think that's to me the most challenging thing. And it's embedded in years and years of habits. And it takes a long time to unwind that.
You know, I used to respond that way, Kurt, and I had a very good mentor, a VP, still a good friend of mine to this day, pulled me aside and said, "Ryan, you got to do something other than freak out when bad news shows up. It's just not a good look." Now, this is me 20 years ago. And he said, "Look, when I get bad news from you, you ever see me yell?" I go, "Nope, you're very calm." And he said, "In my head, I'm thinking, how fascinating." I'm like, it's just a silly phrase that he would say to himself. And I thought it was great advice. And so I'll try to say, how fascinating. And then I added on, what new opportunity exists now? So even in the face of bad news, I think Jocko Willink in Extreme Ownership, his word is just good. Someone gives him bad news, he just says good. And then tries to figure out what can still be done now. And I think that's the essence. That's part of the goal discussion in EBM. It's like, all right, we missed, good. What's the next pivot? What's the next change? How do we stay aligned to that strategic goal? And I think that's the mentality that we're trying to cultivate as we talk about this framework. It's, yeah, something happens we didn't expect. Good. How do we take advantage of that? How do we profit from that? How do we continue to move forward? And I think that's, if that doesn't resonate, you're going to be miserable using this framework.
You know, I can't help but just to add in here with this report that we talked about, the dampening the noise report. And Chad, it's really resonated with you, because it resonated with me too, because there's a moral compass thing happening here. I've had those reports sent back to me and me being told that doesn't look good enough to present at the meeting. And I'm like, but that's the reality of what's happening. And they're like, well, then I'm just going to change it. And then I get my report back and it's changed. And then people ask me questions about it. And I'm like, I just remember sitting there as a product owner and being like, that's not at all what I said. And then I would say that's not at all what I said, get called into an office and told I can't say the things that I should be saying because it offends people. And I'm like, I just told you that we're not going to make the time that you want us to make because we can't. And I've decided to trim a couple things about that. I understand that you need to get it to market. You want to get this thing to market. That's not going to happen. And they're like, well, make it happen. I'm like, there's a reality disconnect. And then there's people like the product owners or the people having to fill out that report that just feel dirty doing it. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the hope though is that by adopting us and looking at this, that we can get rid of that. We can, as Kurt was saying, we can start to create an aura, we can create around our organization that it's okay to tell the truth from what's happening. I mean, it's weird to say, but with all the politics and bureaucracy and the things that happen, it sometimes doesn't feel like we can. And these reports oftentimes contribute to that. So I feel you, Chad, because I've had to fill them out and I felt like I was lying a lot.
And when I said trauma, I mean, I'm half joking, because I mean, I probably told this story on the podcast before, maybe not, but I all of it resonates with me. I lived and breathed the pain of the negative stories in this book, right? The status quo of winning an award for bringing a project in on time, under budget, and yet the product was a disaster. And you'd throw it in your desk drawer and be ashamed of it, right? Because the aftermath was people burned out, relationships damaged. I was spinning scrum teams up in stealth mode, and I was trying to flip my project to red as quick as possible. That was kind of a fun thing to do as a PM. Like, I'm gonna try to go as red as quick as possible. But that was against the flow, right? And I remember one time there was a manager, the sponsor of the project. We were in the steering committee meeting because there wasn't an official sprint review, stealth mode scrum teams. And he was literally, I can't describe the amount of sweat coming off of his forehead, because he knew I was going to say the project was red. Like, that's the level of trauma. He was so scared that I was going to do this because of, you know, fear of retaliation, because you have to be green. And turns out the world didn't melt down. I said we were red. The CEO wanted to know why. We had a conversation. The icing on the cake was, because I had scrum teams in stealth mode, I showed a little demo at the steering committee, and they're like, we've never seen one of these before. Can we do more of these? So there was some, it was a, you know, feedback sandwich maybe. I hit the negatives first, but I ended with some positives. But anyway, I'm clearly not the only person, right? Me and you, Todd, are not the only people who have gone through this. Unfortunately, it's 2023, almost 2024, and there are still organizations approaching product development with phase-gated approaches and the cultures that we're talking about. Like, there's still a lot of organizations feeling the pain that this...
Well, they're all real stories, right? So I wonder if nobody will work with us anymore.
Yeah.
We're just over there spilling tea. It's not good.
You know, but I think as consultants, a lot of times you have gone through the pain and you see that, recognize the pain in another organization. You're like, I've been there. I found a different approach. Let's try this. You kind of have to experience the negative before you can help somebody with a positive approach. So,
well, I think suffering is a prerequisite to learning and growth.
Yeah.
Like, you have to suffer through the solutions and the ideas. Otherwise, they just don't stick.
Yeah,
right.
There's two thoughts on that. One is that there's a great quote, and I don't remember who said it anymore, is that good judgment comes from experience, most of which comes from bad judgment. The second point is that one of the big mistakes that people make in the traditional organization is that they assume that the plan is right or the goal is right and the execution is bad. So when you're off plan, you know, when you didn't hit the plan, it's like, ooh, you know, you're bad, you're executing poorly. But, you know, if you think about how plans are made, they're just pulling stuff out of you know where. I mean, somebody sits down in a room, they don't know anything about the problem and they don't know anything about the solution and they aren't probably even technical. And they come up with this plan. And they go, oh, we need to be to market by, you know, 4 months from now. Because of what? Well, you know, that's fine. Actually, EBM can deal with that. You know, we can deal with crappy goals because you'll inspect and adapt and you'll find out the goal is not the goal you want. And then, you know, you adapt that usually with, you know, your short term and intermediate goals first and then longer term strategic. But, you know, I mean, that's why I said earlier, you know, distrust everything. You know, assume that your goals are bad and figure out, almost like what you said, Chad, you know, figure out how to find that out as quickly as possible. You know, turn that project red as quickly as possible, find out where the squishy parts are, and then you can start to work on that. But, you know, if you assume that your goals are great and then any, you know, deviance from the plan is bad, you're just heading for disaster. So anyway, we talk a lot about that, but I think that that's another thing that's hard for people to say, because usually the goals are, especially the strategic ones, are concocted by people way up in the organization.
So they can't be wrong.
Well, and absolutely, except they often are. And that's where it's really important for people at higher levels in the organization to be what I think, Chad or Jeff, you said earlier, is to be humble and to realize, you know what, I don't, you know, I'm not necessarily closest to this. I have a good idea where we want to go, but, you know, and so devising those goals collaboratively ends up being really important, because then people buy into the goals and they say, hey, you know what, I could get behind that. May not be perfect, but, you know, yeah, we'll work toward that. But if you punish people for not meeting the bad goals, then, you know, you set up a whole cascade of really bad, you know, sort of, you know, people are unhappy, they don't perform well, they're not, you know, they're not committed, they check out, and all that sort of engagement metrics that you can look at.
You know, one of the coolest experiments I ever ran, you know, my background is in executive leadership. I basically said all of the projects in my department are red as of right now. And I required that every project team earn their way as fast as responsibly possible to green. through evidence, not through conjecture or hopes or wishes or dreams, right? And it was an uproar. You know, fortunately, and I find there's a perception of, well, we can't tell upper management the truth. I don't know. I've always had good experiences walking into a VP or a C-level's office and saying, here's what I believe to be true. Here's the evidence that I believe supports it. Mm-hmm. What do you think, or what are you seeing, or what am I missing? Mm-hmm. And I've usually 9 times out of 10, I've had a good conversation there. Didn't always get what I wanted, but it was a positive experience. But I'll tell you what, just flipping to red and being skeptical like Kurt and demanding the evidence that you're green and working there because you're admitting up front you're wrong shifts the way everybody looks at these initiatives, right? It also gets you in a lot of meetings. So be careful with that one.
All right. I'm just curious. I want to do a quick lightning round because I feel like I've had these questions even going into this because maybe one of you can even shed some light on this, but I swear early versions of EBM, they were very software focused. And it's changed over the years, I believe. So quick lightning round. Will this only work for teams developing software?
No, but you are correct. It used to be called evidence-based management for software organizations.
Cool. Okay. So I wasn't crazy. That's a good enough answer on the lightning round. I expected it to be no. You don't also, like, I don't know, Jeff and I were commenting earlier, we don't tie all the goals to product goals and sprint goals. And you don't, like, shove Scrum terminology down the reader's throat either. So question on my mind is, does this only work if you're using Scrum? Yes or no?
So this is where Todd was the most anal retentive, and I love him for it. This is where he kept, because Trish and I especially kept sprinkling the words Agile and Scrum back into chapters. And Todd and Kurt, and especially Todd, were like, no, this is not an Agile book. This is not a Scrum book. This is an evidence-based management book. And so I can emphatically say this works outside of Scrum and Agile. Todd, you planned a marathon.
I used the goal structure and a twist on the KVAs to accomplish a trail ultra marathon. And one of the first people to read the book was a friend of mine who is a director at an inpatient mental health facility and asked me how they could apply the concepts to this to better their department. My wife, I would take our chapters to and fact check and say, is this human readable for you? Because you run a data analytics department for a insurance brokerage. And she was like, yes, I want more of this. I need more of this. And so the thing is, it can be applied to now that you have to twist it a little bit for personal use. Like, ability to innovate for me for that was I injured? Was I getting hurt? Right. Because if I was getting hurt and or I wasn't maintaining a certain degree of flexibility, then I was unable to train. Right. So that you could just conceptually use these things. And then once you see them, you can't unsee them, similar to like queuing theory. That's what I say.
Well, I mean, we even use it for our training company. So Agile for Humans is run with EBM and ability to innovate. You'd think, well, what's there? I think Todd landed on this really great insight. Calendar time. Our calendars represents a big chunk of our ability to innovate. If we're fully booked, we don't have time to write books and to, you know, do the white papers and the podcasts and the blogging. So we watch that. And I mean, it's a modification, but I think it works beautifully in so many different areas and applications.
Yeah. So that's a good answer because I'll admit, like, even going into reading it, I had that rattling around in my head because of the origins of how it was conceived. And so, you know, I guess there, you might find that you have to not pay attention to certain metrics or maybe not use some of the, like, installed version index sounds very software-like, right? But if you're a health system and you have a policy or procedure out on the floor in a hospital, is that really installed version index? I don't know, but it's your current operating procedure. And maybe there's some verbiage you tweak where you can still get value from that. So also, you wouldn't have to use everything, right? That's the point. Take what's valuable for you to use within those key value areas.
Yeah. So in the EBM guide, Kerr and I had made that distinction to move the metrics, so the KVMs, into the appendix. And we used to work with just the KVAs, actually three KVAs at that time. We didn't have unrealized values. And then it was really that gold piece that Kurt identified that we needed to add in there, which is the hardest piece, but it helped it make a lot more sense.
One thing that it might be worth thinking about for those people who are familiar with Scrum is that you can think of Scrum as a specific instance of EBM. So, you know, Scrum is more specific about, you know, the roles and the events and things like that. But, you know, it has short-term goals. It has intermediate-term goals. It has product goals. And it doesn't have strategic goals so much, but, you know, if you think about it, you know, Scrum is an empirical framework that's very specific about, you know, who does what, when, you know, especially with the events. What we did with EBM is to generalize that and sort of take the specific roles out and take the specific events out, but leave behind, in a sense, the goal and the empirical inspect and adapt framework. And so if somebody was thinking, you know, what's sort of a meta Scrum framework, EBM is kind of that thing. But in doing so, as others have said, you know, we needed to take the software piece out of it because this applies to anything where you need to inspect and adapt. And we added the goals piece, especially the strategic and intermediate goals. We added that in because inspect and adapt towards what? You know, so we needed to add goals in. And the reason for adding, you know, originally we didn't have unrealized value, but then the question is, well, you know, should you always just keep increasing current value? Is that always a good thing? You hit a point of diminishing returns. And so we need unrealized value to tell us, have we reached the point of diminishing returns and we should now focus on something else?
Yeah. We're always looking at what can we strip out and what might be missing that will hurt, I guess, the principles of EBM and the foundations of it. So we're always thinking about that, and we'll actually be looking at an update to the EBM guide soon. That's all I'll say. But even thinking about, you know, Kurt and I were thinking about a portfolio level framework, and we're like, if they just keep the concepts of EBM, and we have a chapter in the book, right, applying EBM at the portfolio level, I think that's enough. So.
Yeah, I mean, what I love too is it also enhances even current MBA courseware that's being taught, right? There's always the, well, should we go global at this point? Should we grow in different regions? That's the tactical talked about in an MBA. Should you do it? And the unrealized value piece, I think, fills that gap of answering why. Well, why would we want to go global right now? Well, because we've got a great product and there's untapped markets, right? Like, there's so much to that, I think, that aligns with other things that all those key decision makers and organizations are probably already speaking that language, and this enhances it. I would say so.
I'd certainly love to see every college and university add that to their curriculum.
Harvard, Stanford, you're listening.
Let's get it in there.
Cool. Okay. Are we going to shift to some plugs?
Yeah, let's do that. One more round robin. What do you want to plug to our listeners? Anything? I mean, besides the book, we've talked about the book for the last 45 minutes, but what else? What else is going on? What else do you want to let people know about?
The book is the book's the star of this one. I mean, you can find Todd and I at agileforhumans.com and the YouTube channel, youtube.com/agileforhumans. Tons of content out there. Check it out. Leave us a message. Let us know what you like, what you don't like. And would love to hear more from everyone else, especially about the book.
Awesome.
So on something sort of related but different is that with a former colleague of mine, we've written a whole series on software architecture that's on InfoQ. So if you search on my name or my co-author's name, Pierre Pureur, harder to spell probably. But anyway, we've basically taken this more down to the more practical software sense, but a lot of the same ideas. So that's sort of been my side project for the last year or so that, you know, just sort of a fun thing to take me back to where this all began for me. And then, you know, we've also got a lot of interesting blogs and things like that on EBM on the scrum.org site. best thing to do is go to the Resource Center and do a search on some of the concepts you find in the book, and you might find other blogs, usually probably older content, to be honest. We've got most of the latest thinking in the book, so but you know, you might find some interesting background.
Yeah, so like I said, we're thinking about the EBM guide and what needs to be updated. We're going to be putting up fresher resources about EBM on the scrum.org website. We're kind of, you know, recovering from the writing, but now we're writing blogs and thinking about how would you use EBM with Scrum, et cetera, et cetera. On the scrum.org side, I usually think a lot about enterprise stuff, but what I've been doing is trying to think about people at the team level and how to help them with their learning. So curating a lot of information and trying to make sure we have quality stuff for the Scrum Masters, you know, from getting started to advancing, product owners, developers, and agile leaders. And then I've also been writing a separate book. So we'll talk about that at another time at the for the team and leadership. So
cool.
Maybe you'll have me on the podcast again.
Yeah, awesome. Definitely.
Yeah. I think you should get Jocko to do a promo for this book, right? Are your projects always red? Good. Like,
good.
We should put that in the show notes, that the link to Jocko's video. I mean, it's very inspirational. But you should, yeah.
Oh, I think if you can adopt that mindset, you're going to win in this world. It's the way to be.
Well, one final plug. I think of the EBM book as being the companion to a book that I wrote last year, I guess it was, called The Professional Agile Leader. So if you look at that book, that's about a lot of the supportive behaviors that managers and executives need to have in order to really make EBM work. So, you know, EBM is sort of like the measurement framework and the goal framework part of it. And then the other one is more the soft skills of leadership. Is in the Professional Agile Leader book. So I'm hoping that those will be sold as a bundle on places like Amazon and Pearson and all that. But if they're not, I'd say take a look at it.
Great. We'll get all that stuff in the show notes. Thanks, everyone. I think this worked out well for six people.
If you found value in today's episode, share this with a friend. Until next time, get agile. Stay agile.